Avenue on Caladan. Some places I don't see, shadowed places, as though it went behind a hill. And again he thought of the surface of a blowing kerchief. And there are branchings. He fell silent, as memory of that seeing filled him. No prescient dream, no experience of his life had quite prepared him for the totality with which the veils had been ripped away to reveal naked time. Recalling the experience, he recognized his own terrible purpose. The pressure of his life spreading outward like an expanding bubble, time retreating before it. Jessica found the tent's glow tab control, activated it. Dim green light drove back the shadows, easing her fear. She looked at Paul's face, his eyes, the inward stare. And she knew where she had seen such a look before. Pictured in records of disasters, on the faces of children who experienced Steadily, the Nabaran moved backward, turning to the right, his second barb ready. The slave danced sideways. Fade Rautha appeared to stumble, heard the scream from the galleries. Again the slave pounced. Gods, what a fighting man, Fade Rautha thought as he leaped aside. Only youth's quickness saved him, but he left the second barb buried in the deltoid muscle of the slave's right arm. Shrill cheers rained from the galleries. They cheer me now, Fade Rautha thought. He heard the wildness in the voices, just as Howard had said he would. They'd never cheered a family fighter that way before. And he thought with an edge of grimness on a thing Howard had told him, it's easier to be terrified by an enemy you admire. Swiftly, Fade Rautha retreated to the center of the arena, where all could see clearly. He drew his long blade, crouched and waited for the advancing slave. The man took only the time to lash the second barb tight to his arm, then sped in pursuit. Fell back into the chair, so quickly did his muscles betray him. She smiled without mirth. "Now you know something of the real training they give us," she said. Howard tried to swallow in a dry throat. Her command had been regal, peremptory, uttered in a tone and manner he had found completely irresistible. His body had obeyed her before he could think about it. Nothing could have prevented his response, not logic, not passionate anger, nothing. To do what she had done spoke of a sensitive, intimate knowledge of the person thus commanded, a depth of control he had not dreamed possible. "I have said to you before that we should understand each other," she said. "I meant you should understand me. I already understand you. And I tell you now that your loyalty to the Duke is all that guarantees your safety with me." He stared at her, wet his lips with his tongue. "If I desired a puppet, the Duke would marry me," she said. "He might even think he did it of his own free will."
Where they halted, clear of sudden attack. "How long will it be before the elves get here?" said Susan. "Not long," said Albanac. "They will have left Fundendelv as soon as the light grew poor, and their horses are fleet as Melunnas when there is need."
Howat lowered his head, looked upward through his sparse lashes. Only the most rigid control kept him from calling the guard. Control, and the suspicion now that woman might not permit it. His skin crawled with the memory of how she had controlled him. In the moment of hesitation, she could have drawn a weapon and killed him. "Does every human have this blind spot?" he wondered. "Can any of us be ordered into action before he can resist?" The idea staggered him. Who could stop a person with such power? "You've glimpsed the fist within the Bene Gesserit glove," she said. "Few glimpse it and live. And what I did was a relatively simple thing for us. You've not seen my entire arsenal. Think on that." "Why aren't you out destroying the Duke's enemies?" he asked. "What would you have me destroy?" she asked. "Would you have me make a weakling of our Duke? Have him forever lean?"
Then Colin said, "Listen. Can you hear that?"
"Let the family see me do this thing," Fade Rautha thought. "I am their enemy. Let them think of me as they see me now." He drew his short blade.
I do not fear you, Harkonnen swine, the gladiator said. Your tortures cannot hurt a dead man. I can be dead on my own blade before a handler lays finger to my flesh, and I'll have you dead beside me. Feyd-Rautha grinned, offered now the long blade, the one with the poison. Try this on, he said, and feinted with the short blade in his other hand. The slave shifted knife hands, turned inside, both parry and feint, to grapple the Nabaran's short blade, the one in the white-gloved hand that tradition said should carry the poison. You will die, Harkonnen, the gladiator gasped. They struggled sideways across the sand. Where Feyd-Rautha's shield met the slave's half-shield, a blue glow marked the contact, the air around them filled with ozone from the field. Die on your own poison, the slave grated. He began forcing the white glacian or terrible injury. The eyes were like pits, mouth a straight line, cheeks indrawn. It's the look of terrible awareness, she thought, of someone forced to the knowledge of his own mortality. He was, indeed, no longer a child. The underlying import of his words began to take over in her mind, pushing all else aside. Paul could see ahead, a way of escape for them. There's a way to evade the Harkonnens, she said. The Harkonnens, he sneered. Put those twisted humans out of your mind. He stared at his mother, studying the lines of her face in the light of the glow-tab. The lines betrayed her. She said, You shouldn't refer to people as humans without... Don't be so sure you know where to draw the line, he said. We carry our past with us. And, mother mine, there's a thing you don't know and should. We are Harkonnens. Her mind on me? But with such power. Power's a two-edged sword, Thufir, she said. You think how easy for her to shape a human tool to thrust into an enemy's vitals. True, Thufir, even into your vitals. Yet what would I accomplish? If enough of us Bene Gesserit did this, wouldn't it make all Bene Gesserit suspect? We don't want that, Thufir. We do not wish to destroy ourselves, she nodded. We truly exist only to serve. I cannot answer you, he said. You know I cannot answer. You'll say nothing about what has happened here to anyone, she said. I know you, Thufir. My lady. Again the old man tried to swallow in a dry throat, and he thought, She has great powers, yes. But would these not make her an even more formidable tool for the Harkonnens? The Duke could be destroyed as quickly by his friends as by his enemies, she said. I trust now you'll get to the bottom of this suspicion.
They crossed the stream to a flat meadowland, where the horses would have better grazing. The sky was yellow, the black clouds of night drifting in, giving a stark quietness to the valley. But this was broken with a shock that made the horses rear as a...
I hear a night sound, that is all.
Listen. It's music, like voices calling and bells of ice. And look! There's the track!
Suddenly, through the trees and over the beacon hill...
And remove it. If it proves baseless, he said. If, she sneered. If, he said. You are tenacious, she said. Cautious, he said, and aware of the error factor. Then I'll pose another question for you. What does it mean to you that you stand before another human, that you are bound and helpless, and the other human holds a knife at your throat, yet this other human refrains from killing you, frees you from your bonds, and gives you the knife to use as you will? She lifted herself out of the chair, turned her back on him. You may go now, Thufir. The old Mentat arose, hesitated, hand creeping toward the deadly weapon beneath his tunic. He was reminded of the bull ring and of the Duke's father, who'd been brave, no matter what his other failings, and one day of the corrida long ago. The fierce black beast had stood there, head bowed, immobilized and confused. The old Duke had turned his back on the horns, cape thrown flamed hand inward, turning the blade he thought carried the poison. Let them see this, Feyd-Rautha thought. He brought down the long blade, felt it clang uselessly against the barbed shaft lashed to the slave's arm. Fade Ratha felt a moment of desperation. He hadn't thought the barbed shafts would be an advantage for the slave, but they gave the man another shield. And the strength of this gladiator! The short blade was being forced inward inexorably, and Fade Ratha focused on the fact that a man could also die on an unpoisoned blade. "Scum!" Fade Ratha gasped. At the key word, the gladiator's muscles obeyed with a momentary slackness. It was enough for Fade Ratha. He opened a space between them sufficient for the long blade. Its poisoned tip flicked out, drew a red line down the slave's chest. There was instant agony in the poison. The man disengaged himself, staggered backward. "Now let my dear family watch," Fedor's black-bearded visage above him, the dark eyes glaring with battle-like.
Og howled close by. "Where is that?" cried Albulac.
"Yonder," said Uthaka, "high on the hill."
And there by the dead trees where Uthaka had killed the Bodach loped the shape of a black dog. It was as big as a calf. A shimmering line had flowed, a mesh of silver threads, each glistening, alive. Colin had seen something like it once before, on a rare morning when the sun had cut a path through the dewed, invisible carpet of spiders' webs that covered the fields. That had been...
did a terrifying thing. It blanked out, as though it needed to shut off all sensation. But Paul's voice went on at that implacable pace, dragging her with it. "When next you find a mirror, study your face. Study mine now. The traces are there if you don't blind yourself. Look at my hands, the set of my bones. And if none of this convinces you, then take my word for it. I've walked the future. I've looked at a record. I've seen a place. I have all the data. We're Harkonnens." "A renegade branch of the family," she said. "That's it, isn't it? Some Harkonnen cousin who..." "You're the Baron's own daughter," he said, and watched the way she pressed her hands to her mouth. "The Baron sampled many pleasures in his youth, and once permitted himself to be seduced. But it was for the genetic purposes of the Bene Gesserit, by one of you." The way he said "you" struck her like a slap. But it set her mind to working, and she could not deny his words. So buoyantly over one arm, while cheers rained down from the stands. "I am the bull and she the matador," Howard thought. He withdrew his hand from the weapon, glanced at the sweat glistening in his empty palm. And he knew that whatever the facts proved to be in the end, he would never forget this moment nor lose this sense of supreme admiration for the Lady Jessica. Quietly, he turned and left the room. Jessica lowered her gaze from the reflection in the windows, turned and stared at the closed door. "Now we'll see some proper action," she whispered.
Do you wrestle with dreams? Do you contend with shadows? Do you move in a kind of sleep? Time has slipped away. Your life is stolen. You tarried with trifles, victim of your folly.
And so indistinct against the trees in that light as to appear to be made of smoke. It put back its head, and the loneliness bayed again, and then the dog slipped through the wood, and they did not see it. Albinac sat with his head bowed.
Dirge for Jamis on the funeral plain from Songs of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
Leto stood in the foyer of his house, studying a note by the light of a single suspensor lamp. Dawn was yet a few hours away, and he felt his tiredness. A Fremen messenger had brought the note to the outer guard just now as the Duke arrived from his command post. The note read, "A column of smoke by day, a pillar of fire by night." There was no signature. What does it mean? He wondered. The messenger had gone without waiting for an answer, and before he could be questioned, he had slipped into the night like some smoky shadow. Leto pushed the paper into a tunic pocket, thinking to show it to Hawat later. He brushed a lock of hair from his forehead, took a sighing breath. The anti-fatigue pills were beginning to wear thin. It had been a long 2 days since the dinner party, and longer than that since he had slept. On top of all the military problems, there
thing to the beauty he saw now, the track quivered under his feet, and he gazed at it as though spellbound.
"Run!" called Uthika. "Do not waste your time!"
"But which way?" cried Colin. "It stretched left and right as far as I can see,"
speaking for a long time after the voice had died. Uthika looked at him, but did not move, and the weight that lay on both of them was felt by Susan. Albanac drew a deep breath. The howl of Ossar.
The blank ends of meaning in her past reached out now and linked. The daughter the Bene Gesserit wanted. It wasn't to end the old Atreides-Harkonnen feud, but to fix some genetic factor in their lines. What? She groped for an answer. As though he saw inside her mind, Paul said, "They thought they were reaching for me, but I'm not what they expected. And I've arrived before my time, and they don't know it." Jessica pressed her hands to her mouth.
"Great Mother, he's the Kwisatz Haderach."
She felt exposed and naked before him, realizing then that he saw her with eyes from which little could be hidden. And that, she knew, was the basis of her fear. "You're thinking I'm the Kwisatz Haderach," he said. "Put that out of your mind. I'm something unexpected."
"I must get word out to one of the schools," she thought. "The mating index may show what has happened."
They won't have been the disquieting session with Howard, the report on his meeting with Jessica. Should I waken Jessica? He wondered. There's no reason to play the secrecy game with her any longer, or is there? Blast and damn that Duncan, Idaho. He shook his head. No, not Duncan. I was wrong not to take Jessica into my confidence from the first. I must do it now, before more damage is done. The decision made him feel better, and he hurried from the foyer through the great hall and down the passages toward the family wing. At the turn where the passages split to the service area, he paused. A strange mewling came from somewhere down the service passage. Leto put his left hand to the switch on his shield belt, slipped his kinjal into his right hand. The knife conveyed a sense of reassurance. That strange sound had sent a chill through him. Softly, the Duke moved down the service passage, cursing the inadequate illumination. The smallest of suspensers had been spaced about 8 meters apart along here and tuned to their dimmest level.
"To the east, to the hills, quickly! The track will be lost when the moon passes from it. Run, run, and fortune follow you!"
Colin leapt down the hill, and his feet were winged with silver. Trees blurred around him once he felt golden, he said. But even as he spoke, they heard a drumming in the air, growing louder, and the skyline was broken with movement as though an army was rising out of the heather, and down from Shining Tor rode the Leos Alpha with Nick.
The dark stone walls swallowed the light. A dull blob stretching across the floor appeared out of the gloom ahead. Leto hesitated, almost activated his shield, but refrained because that would limit his movements, his hearing, and because the captured shipment of laser guns had left him filled with doubts. Silently he moved toward the gray blob, saw that it was a human figure, a man face down on the stone. Leto turned him over with a foot, knife poised, bent close in the dim light to see the face. It was the smuggler, Tuek, a wet stain down his chest. The dead eyes stared with empty darkness. Leto touched the stain. Warm. How could this man be dead here? Leto asked himself. Who killed him? The mewling sound was louder here. It came from ahead and down the side passage to the central room where they had installed the main shield generator for the house. Hand on belt switch, Kinjal pointed about me until it's too late, he said. She sought to divert him, lowered her hands and said, We'll find a place among the Fremen. The Fremen have a saying they credit to Shai-Hulud, Old Father Eternity, he said. They say, be prepared to appreciate what you meet. And he thought, yes, mother mine, among the Fremen. You'll acquire the blue eyes and a callus beside your lovely nose from the filter tube to your stillsuit. And you'll bear my sister, Saint Alia of the Knife.
If you're not the Kwisatz Haderach, Jessica said, what?
You couldn't possibly know, he said. You won't believe it until you see it. And he thought,
I am a seed. He suddenly saw how fertile was the ground into which he had fallen. And with this realization, the terrible purpose filled him, creeping through the empty place within, threatening to choke him with grief. He had seen two main branchings along the way ahead. In one, he confronted an evil old baron and said, "Hello, grandfather."
Swords in their hands, and the blades like flame. They halted in a swirling crowd after the momentum of the hill, but they did not speak, even among themselves.
"We are come," said Adlendor to Almanac. "Where is the Morrigan?"
Poised, the Duke skirted the body, slipped down the passage, and peered around the corner toward the shield generator room. Another grey blob lay stretched on the floor a few paces away, and he saw at once this was the source of the noise. The shape crawled toward him with painful slowness, gasping, mumbling. Leto stilled his sudden constriction of fear, darted down the passage, crouched beside the crawling figure. It was Mapes, the Fremen housekeeper. Her hair tumbled around her face, clothing disarrayed. A dull shininess of dark stains spread from her back along her side. He touched her shoulder and she lifted herself on her elbows, head tipped up to peer at him, the eyes black-shadowed emptiness.
"Sew," she gasped. "Killed guard sent get to escape. M'lady, you here no."
She flopped forward, her head thumping
stone hard beneath him. Then he burst from the wood, and there was the old stray track, dipping and flowing over the rounded fields and rising, a silver thread like a distant mountain stream, up the face of the hills to the peak of Shining Tor, and behind it the broad disk of the moon.
Against the stone. Leto felt for pulse at the temples. There was none. He looked at the stain. She'd been stabbed in the back. Who? His mind raced. Did she mean someone had killed a guard? And Tuek, had Jessica sent for him? Why? He started to stand up. A sixth sense warned him. He flashed a hand toward the shield switch. Too late. A numbing shock slammed his arm aside. He felt pain there, saw a dart protruding from the sleeve, sensed paralysis spreading from it up his arm. It took an agonizing effort to lift his head and look down the passage. Yui stood in the open door of the generator room. His face reflected yellow from the light of a single, brighter suspensor above the door. There was stillness from the room behind him. No sound of generators. "Yui," Leto thought. "He sabotaged the house generators. We're wide open." Yui began walking toward him, pocketing a dart gun. Leto found he could
"We have not seen her, but she will be close," said Abenak. "We did this minute leave the house. It is ringed with fires, and the ground is clear, though on one side there is much against us. Neither Bodach nor Palag has been found."
"I smell them."
The thought of that path and what lay along it sickened him. The other path held long patches of grey obscurity except for peaks of violence. He had seen a warrior religion there, a fire spreading across the universe with the Atreides' green and black banner waving at the head of fanatic legions, drunk on spice liquor. Gurney Halleck and a few others of his father's men, a pitiful few, were among them, all marked by the hawk symbol from the shrine of his father's skull. "I can't go that way," he muttered. "That's what the old witches of your schools really want." "I don't understand you, Paul," his mother said.
Said Tanis softly, his voice lost in the commotion. "It all fits." As Eben ran for the mines, his one thought was to obey Pyros's command. Somehow, in the midst of this furor, he had to find the Green Gemstone Man. He knew what Verminard and Pyros were going to do to these poor wretches. Eben felt a moment's pity. He was not, after all, cruel and vicious. He had simply seen, long ago, which side was bound to win. And he determined, for once, to be on a winning side. When his family's fortune was wiped out, Eben was left with only one thing to sell. Himself. He was intelligent, handy with a sword, and as loyal as money could buy. It was on a journey to the north looking for possible buyers that Eben met Verminard. Eben had been impressed with Verminard's power and had wormed his way into the evil cleric's favor, but more importantly, he had managed to make himself useful to Pyros. The dragon found Eben charming, intelligent, resourceful, and, after a few tests, trustworthy. Eben was sent home to Gateway just before the dragon armies struck. He conveniently escaped and started his resistance group. Stumbling upon Gilthanas's party of elves the first time they tried to sneak into Pax Tharkas was a stroke of luck that further improved Eben's relationship with both Pyros and Verminard. When the cleric actually fell into Eben's hands, he couldn't believe his luck. It must go to show how much the Dark Queen favored him, he supposed. He prayed that the Dark Queen continue to favor him. Finding the green gemstone man in this confusion was going to take divine intervention. Hundreds of men were milling about uncertainly. Eben saw a chance to do Verminard another favor.
"Tanis wants you men to meet in the courtyard," he cried. "Join your families." "No, that isn't the plan,"
Elistan cried, trying to stop them. But he was too late. The men, seeing their families free, surged forward. Several hundred gully dwarves added to the confusion, rushing gleefully out of the mines to join the fun, thinking, perhaps, it was a holiday. Eben scanned the crowd anxiously for the green gemstone man, then decided to look inside the prison cells. Sure enough, he found the man sitting alone, staring vaguely around the empty cell. Eben swiftly knelt beside him, racking his brain to come up with the man's name. It was something odd. Old-fashioned. "Barum?" Eben said after a moment. "Barum?" The man looked up, interest lighting his face for the first time in many weeks. He was not, as Turda had assumed, deaf and dumb. He was instead a man obsessed, totally absorbed in his own secret quest. He was human, however, and the sound of a human voice speaking his name was inordinately comforting. "Barum," said Eben again, licking his lips nervously. Now that he had him, he wasn't sure what to do with him. He knew the first thing those poor wretches outside would do when the dragon struck would be to head for the safety of the mines. He had to get Barum out of here before Tanis caught them, but where? He could take the man inside Pax Tharkas, as Pyros had ordered, but Eben didn't like that idea. Verminard would certainly find them, and, his suspicions aroused, would ask questions Eben couldn't answer. No. There was only one place Eben could take him and be safe, outside the walls of Pax Tharkas. They could lie low in the wilderness until the confusion died, then sneak back inside the fortress at night. His decision made, Eben took Barum's arm and helped the man rise to his feet. "There's going to be fighting," he said. "I'm going to take you away, keep you safe until it is over. I am your friend. Do you understand?" The man regarded him with a look of penetrating wisdom and intelligence. It was not the ageless look of the elves, but of a human who has lived in torment for countless years. Barum gave a small sigh and nodded. Verminard strode from his chamber in a fury, yanking at his leather, armored gloves. A draconian trotted behind him, carrying the High Lord's mace, Nightbringer. Other draconians milled around, acting on the orders Verminard gave as he stepped into the corridor, returning to Pyros's lair.
"No, you fools! Don't recall the army! This will take but a moment of my time! Qualinaste here will be in flames by nightfall! Remember!"
he shouted, throwing open the doors that led to the dragon's lair. He stepped out onto the ledge, peering upward toward the balcony. He could see smoke and flame, and in the distance. Hear the dragon's roar.
Ember!
There was no answer.
How long does it take to capture a handful of spies?
He demanded furiously. Turning, he nearly fell over a draconian captain.
Will you be using the dragon's saddle, my lord?
No, there isn't time. Besides, I use that only for combat, and there will be no one to fight out there, simply a few hundred slaves to burn.
But the slaves have overcome the guards at the mine and are rejoining their families in the courtyard.
How strong are your forces?
Not nearly strong enough, my lord.
The draconian captain said, its eyes glinting. The captain had never thought it wise to deplete the garrison.
We are 40 or 50, perhaps, to over 300 men and an equal number of women. The women will undoubtedly fight alongside the men, your lordship, and if they ever get organized and escape into the mountains...
Bah! Ember!
Verminard called. He heard, in another part of the fortress, a heavy metallic thud. Then he heard another sound, the great wheel, unused in centuries, creaking with protest at being forced into labor. Verminard was wondering what these odd sounds portended when Pyros flew down into his lair. The dragon High Lord ran to the ledge as Pyros dropped past him. Verminard climbed swiftly and skillfully onto the dragon's back. Though separated by mutual distrust, the two fought well together. Their hatred for the petty races they strove to conquer, combined with their desire for power, joined them in a bond much stronger than either cared to admit.
Fly!
Verminard roared, and Pyros rose into the air.
It is useless, my friend,
Tanis said quietly to Sturm, laying his hand on the knight's shoulder as Sturm frantically called for order.
You're only wasting your breath. Save it for fighting.
There'll be no fighting,
Sturm coughed, hoarse from shouting.
We'll die, trapped like rats. Why won't these fools listen?
He and Tanis stood at the northern end of the courtyard, about 20 feet from the front gates of Pax Tharkas. Looking south, they could see the mountains and hope. Behind them were the great gates of the fortress that would at any moment open to admit the vast draconian army, and within these walls, somewhere, were Verminard and the Red Dragon. In vain, Elistan sought to calm the people and urge them to move southward, but the men insisted on finding their womenfolk, and women on finding their children. A few families, together again, were starting to move south, but too late and too slowly. Then, like a blood-red flaming comet, Pyros soared from the fortress of Pax Tharkas, his wings sleek, held close to his sides, his huge tail trailed behind him. His taloned forefeet were curled close to his body as he gained speed in the air. Upon his back rode the Dragon High Lord, the gilded horns of the hideous dragon mask glinting in the morning sun. Verminard held on to the dragon's spiny mane with both hands as they flared into the sunlit sky, bringing night's shadows to the courtyard below. The dragon fear spread over the people. Unable to scream or run, they could only cower before the fearful apparition, arms around each other, knowing death was inevitable. At Verminard's command, Pyros settled on one of the fortress towers. Verminard stared out from behind the horned dragon mask, silent, furious. Tanis, watching in helpless frustration, felt Sturm grip his arm.
Look!
The knight pointed north, toward the gates. Tanis reluctantly lowered his gaze from the Dragon High Lord and saw two figures running toward the gates of the fortress.
Eben!
He cried in disbelief.
But who's that with him?
He won't escape!
Sturm shouted, Before Tanis could stop him, the knight ran after the two. As Tanis followed, he saw a flash of red out of the corner of his eye, Raistlin and his twin.
"I, too, have a score to settle with this man," the mage hissed.
The three caught up with Sturm just as the knight gripped Eben by the collar and hurled him to the ground.
"Traitor!"
Sturm yelled loudly.
"Though I die this day, I'll send you to the abyss first."
He drew his sword and jerked Eben's head back. Suddenly, Eben's companion whirled around, came back, and caught hold of Sturm's sword arm. Sturm gasped. His hand loosened its grip on Eben as the knight stared, amazed at the sight before him. The man's shirt had been torn open in his wild flight from the mines. Impaled in the man's flesh, in the center of his chest, was a brilliant green jewel. Sunlight flashed on the gem that was as big around as a man's fist, causing it to gleam with a bright and terrible light, an unholy light.
"I have never seen nor heard of magic like this,"
Raistlin whispered in awe as he and the others stopped, stunned, beside Sturm. Seeing their wide eyes focused on his body, Barum instinctively pulled his shirt over his chest, then loosened his hold on Sturm's arm. He turned and ran for the gates. Eben scrambled to his feet and stumbled after him. Sturm leaped forward, but Tanis stopped him.
"No," he said. "It's too late. We have others to think of." "Tanis, look!"
Caramon shouted, pointing above the huge gates. A section of the stone wall of the fortress above the massive front gates began to open, forming a huge, widening crack. Slowly, at first, then with increasing speed, the massive granite boulders began to fall from the crack, smashing to the ground with such force that the flagstone cracked and great clouds of dust rose into the air. Above the roar could be dimly heard the sound of the massive chains releasing the mechanism. The boulders began to fall just as Eben and Barum arrived at the gates. Eben shrieked in terror, instinctively and pitifully raised his arm to shield his head. The man next to him glanced up and, it seemed, gave a small sigh. Then both were buried under tons of cascading rock as the ancient defense mechanism sealed shut the gates of Pax Tharkas.
"This is your final act of defiance!"
Verminard roared. His speech had been interrupted by the fall of the rocks, an act that only enraged him more.
"I offered you a chance to work to further the glory of my queen. I cared for you and your families. But you are stubborn and foolish. You will pay with your lives!"
The dragon High Lord raised Nightbringer high in the air.
"I will destroy the men. I will destroy the women. I will destroy the children."
At a touch of the dragon High Lord's hand, Pyros spread his huge wings and leaped high into the air. The dragon drew in a deep breath, preparing to swoop down upon the mass of people who wailed in terror in the wide-open courtyard and incinerate them with his fiery breath. But the dragon's deadly dive was stopped. Sweeping up into the sky from the pile of rubble made when she crashed out of the fortress, Matafleur flew straight at Pyros. The ancient dragon had sunk deeper into her madness. Once more she relived the nightmare of losing her children. She could see the knights upon the silver and golden dragons, the wicked dragon lances gleaming in the sunshine. In vain, she pleaded with her children not to join the hopeless fight. In vain, she sought to convince them the war was at an end. They were young and would not listen. They flew off, leaving her weeping in her lair. As she watched in her mind's eye, the bloody, final battle. As she saw her children die upon the dragon lances, she heard Verminard's voice,
"I will destroy the children!"
And, as she had done so many centuries before, Matafleur flew out to defend them. Pyros, stunned by the unexpected attack, swerved just in time to avoid the broken yet still lethal teeth of the old dragon aiming for his unprotected flanks. Matafleur hit him a glancing blow, tearing painfully into one of the heavy muscles that drove the giant wings. Rolling in the air, Pyros lashed out at the passing Matafleur with a wicked, taloned forefoot, tearing a gash in the female dragon's soft underbelly. In her madness, Matafleur did not even feel the pain, but the force of the larger and younger male dragon's blow knocked her backwards in the air. The rollover maneuver had been an instinctive defensive action on the part of the male dragon. He had been able to gain both altitude and time to plan his attack. He had, however, forgotten his rider. Verminard, riding without the dragon saddle he used in battle, lost his grip on the dragon's neck and fell to the courtyard below. It was not a long drop, and he landed, uninjured, only bruised and momentarily shaken. Most of the people around him fled in terror when they saw him rise to his feet, but, glancing around swiftly, he noticed that there were four near the northern end of the courtyard who did not flee. He turned to face those four. The appearance of Matafleur and her sudden attack on Pyros jolted the captive people out of their state of panic. This, combined with the fall of Verminard into their midst, like the fall of some horrifying god, accomplished what Elistan and the others had not. The people were shaken out of their fear, sense returned, and they began fleeing south toward the safety of the mountains. At this sight, the Draconian captain sent his forces pouring into the crowd. He detailed another messenger, a wyvern, to fly from the fortress to recall the army. The Draconians surged into the refugees, but if they hoped to cause a panic, they had failed. The people had suffered enough. They had allowed their freedom to be taken away once in return for the promise of peace and safety. Now they understood that there could be no peace as long as these monsters roamed Kryn. The people of Solace and Gateway, men, women, and children, fought back using every pitiful weapon they could grab, rocks, stones, their own bare hands, teeth, and nails. The companions became separated in the crowd. Lorana was cut off from everyone. Gilthanas had tried to stay near her, but he was carried off in the mob. The elf maiden, more frightened than she believed possible and longing to hide, fell back against the wall of the fortress, her sword in her hand. As she watched the raging battle in horror, a man fell to the ground in front of her, clutching his stomach, his fingers red with his own blood. His eyes, fixed in death, seeming to stare at her as his blood formed a pool at her feet. Lorana stared at the blood in horrid fascination. Then she heard a sound in front of her. Shaking, she looked up, directly into the hideous, reptilian face of the man's killer. The Draconian, seeing an apparently terror-stricken elven female before him, figured on an easy kill. Licking its blood-stained sword with its long tongue, the creature jumped over the body of his victim and lunged for Lorana. Clutching her sword, her throat aching with terror, Lorana reacted out of sheer defensive instinct. She stabbed blindly, jabbing upward. The Draconian was caught totally off guard. Lorana plunged her weapon into the Draconian's body, feeling the sharp elven blade penetrate both armor and flesh, hearing bone splinter and the creature's last gurgling scream. It turned to stone, yanking the sword from her hand. But Lorana, thinking with a cold detachment that amazed her, knew from hearing the warriors talk that if she waited a moment, the stone body would turn to dust, releasing her weapon. The sounds of battle raged around her. The screams, the death cries, the thuds and groans, the clash of steel. But she heard none of it. She waited calmly until she saw the body crumble. Then she reached down, and sifting the dust aside with her hand, she grasped the hilt of her sword and lifted it into the air. Sunlight flashed on the blood-stained blade. Her enemy lay dead at her feet. She looked around but could not see Tanis. She could not see any of the others. For all she knew, they might be dead. For all she knew, she might herself be dead within the next moment. Lorana lifted her eyes to the sun-drenched blue sky. The world she might soon be leaving seemed newly made. Every object, every stone, every leaf stood out in painful clarity. A warm, fragrant southern breeze sprang up, driving back the storm clouds that hung over her homeland to the north. Lorana's spirit, released from its prison of fear, soared higher than the clouds, and her sword flashed in the morning sun. Chapter 15. The Dragon High Lord. Matafleur's Children. Verminard studied the four men as they approached him. These were not slaves, he realized. Then he recognized them as the ones who traveled with the golden-haired cleric. These then were the ones who had defeated Onyx in Zakhtzaroth, escaped the slave caravan, and broken into Pax Tharkas. He felt as if he knew them, the knight from that broken land of past glories, a half-elf trying to pass himself off as human, a deformed, sickly magician, and the mage's twin, a human giant whose brain was probably as thick as his arms. It will be an interesting fight, he thought. He almost welcomed hand-to-hand combat. It had been a long time. He was growing bored with commanding armies from the back of a dragon. Thinking of Ember, he glanced into the sky, wondering if he might be able to summon aid. But it appeared that the red dragon was having his own problems. Matafleur had been fighting battles when Pyros was still in the egg. What she lacked in strength, she made up for in guile and cunning. The air crackled with flames. Dragon blood dropped down like red rain. Shrugging, Verminard looked back at the four approaching him warily. He could hear the magic user reminding his companions that Verminard was a cleric of the Queen of Darkness and, as such, could call upon her aid. Verminard knew from his spies that this magic user, though young, was imbued with a strange power and considered very dangerous. The four did not speak. There was no need for talk among these men, nor was there need for talk between enemies. Respect, grudging as it may be, was apparent on both sides. As for the battle rage, that was unnecessary. This would be fought coolly. The major victor would be death. And so the four came forward, spreading to outflank him since he had nothing to set his back against. Crouching low, Verminard swung Nightbringer in an arc, keeping them back, forming his plans. He must even the odds quickly. Gripping Nightbringer in his right hand, the evil cleric sprang forward from his crouched stance with all the strength in his powerful legs. His sudden move took his opponents by surprise. He did not raise his mace. All he needed now was his deadly touch. Landing on his feet in front of Raistlin, he reached out and grasped the magic user by the shoulder, whispering a swift prayer to his dark queen. Raistlin screamed. His body pierced by unseen, unholy weapons, he sank to the ground in agony. Caramon gave a great, bellowing roar and sprang at Verminard, but the cleric was prepared. He swung the mace, Nightbringer, and struck the warrior a glancing blow. "Midnight!" Verminard whispered, and Caramon's bellow changed to a shout of panic as the spellbound mace blinded him.
"I can't see, Tanis! Help me!"
the big warrior cried, stumbling about. Verminard, laughing grimly, struck him a solid blow to the head. Caramon went down like a felled ox. Out of the corner of his eye, Verminard saw the half-elf leap for him, a two-handed sword of ancient elvish design in his hands. Verminard whirled, blocking Tanis's sword with Nightbringer's massive oaken handle. For a moment, the two combatants were locked together, but Verminard's greater strength won out and he hurled Tanis to the ground. The Salamnic knight raised his sword in salute. A costly mistake. It gave Verminard time to remove a small iron needle from a hidden pocket. Raising it, he called once more upon the Queen of Darkness to defend her cleric. Sturm, striding forward, suddenly felt his body grow heavier and heavier, until he could walk no more. Tanis, lying on the ground, felt an unseen hand press down on him. He couldn't move. He couldn't turn his head. His tongue was too thick to speak. He could hear Raistlin's scream choke off in pain. He could hear Verminard laugh and shout a hymn of praise to the Dark Queen. Tanis could only watch in despair as the dragon High Lord, mace raised, walked towards Sturm, preparing to end the knight's life.
Peravis Karas!
Verminard said in Solamnic. He lifted the mace in a gruesome mockery of the knight's salute, then aimed for the knight's head, knowing that this death would be the most torturous possible for a knight, dying at the mercy of an enemy. Suddenly, a hand caught Verminard's wrist. In astonishment, he stared at the hand of a female. He felt a power to match his own, a holiness to match his unholiness. At her touch, Verminard's concentration wavered, his prayers to his Dark Queen faltered. And then it was that the Dark Queen herself looked up to find a radiant god, dressed in white and shining armor, appear on the horizon of her plans. She was not ready to fight this god. She had not expected his return, and so she fled to rethink her options and restructure her battle, seeing, for the first time, the possibility of defeat. The Queen of Darkness withdrew and left her cleric to his fate. Sturm felt the spell leave his body, his muscles his own to command once more. He saw Verminard turn his fury on Gold Moon, striking at her savagely. The knight lunged forward, seeing Tanis rise, the elven sword flashing in the sunlight. Both men ran toward Gold Moon, but Riverwind was there before them. Thrusting her out of the way, the plainsman received, on his sword arm, the blow of the cleric's mace that had been intended to crush Gold Moon's head. Riverwind heard the cleric shout, "Midnight!" And his vision was obscured by the same unholy darkness that had overtaken Caramon. But the Kuei Xiu warrior, expecting this, did not panic. Riverwind could still hear his enemy. Resolutely ignoring the pain of his injury, he transferred the sword to his left hand and stabbed in the direction of his enemy's harsh breathing. The blade, turned aside by the Dragon High Lord's powerful armor, was jarred from Riverwind's hand. Riverwind fumbled for his dagger, though he knew it was hopeless, that death was certain. At that moment, Verminard realized he was alone, bereft of spiritual help. He felt the cold, skeletal hand of despair clutch at him, and he called to his Dark Queen. but she had turned away, absorbed in her own struggle. Verminard began to sweat beneath the dragon mask. He cursed it as the helm seemed to stifle him. He couldn't catch his breath. Too late he realized its unsuitableness for hand-to-hand combat. The mask blocked his peripheral vision. He saw the tall plainsman, blind and wounded, before him. He could kill him at his leisure. But there were two other fighters near. The knight and the half-elf had been freed of the unholy spell he had cast on them, and they were coming closer. He could hear them. Catching a glimpse of movement, he turned quickly and saw the half-elf running toward him, the elvish blade glistening. But where was the knight?